supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in this show, the answer to an excellent question. If you want to grow lots of your own food, which fruit will produce tasty produce for you the earliest in the season? What a great question! Let's hope I come up with the answer by the time we're done with your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Robin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Robin. How are you?
Good.
And where is Robin Good?
Texarkana, Texas.
What can we do for Robin in Texarkana?
Well, I have a compost heap, and I keep scraps from my kitchen and dump on the heap pretty much every night. But unfortunately, there was some confusion, and my used cooking oil, was accidentally dumped onto the compost heap last week. And I don't know if I need to do something about this or if it'll be okay.
Was this a spousal incident, or are you the guilty party?
We're not going to say.
So, what is the majority of your compost, quote, heap made out of?
Dead leaves and garden scraps.
Okay. And the leaves are deciduous tree leaves. Were they shredded?
Mostly oak, and some shredded and some just really... it's a kind of a casual pile. I just throw whatever I have and, you know, let the nature cook.
Okay. And the garden debris, I presume this is the blasted plants at the end of the season and everything like that?
Yes, unless I know it's a noxious weed. Also, all of my kitchen cooking scraps, all of the vegetables, you know, the trimmings and stuff like that.
The one thing that I warn about, and a lot of people don't want to hear this because they think I'm telling them that they can't recycle their kitchen waste, but when you have an open outdoor pile, you got to be a little careful with kitchen scraps because it's real easy to cross the line from recycling your waste into being a rest home for rats, mice, raccoons, and all sorts of wildlife. That's why I graduated to an indoor worm bin for my kitchen waste. And the only, quote, kitchen waste that I put out into my compost piles are coffee grounds. Because coffee grounds and the kind of leaves you've described are a great combination.
Well, we do put our coffee grounds out there and also eggshells. We have 5 cats, and they tend to keep the critters away.
There you go. There you go. It's always a good idea if you're going to do that to bury them, bury them in the center of the pile. You know, most cats can't take on a rat, and they certainly can't take on a raccoon. So you don't want them to be doing that. They're good at keeping Mickey and Minnie under control. So how large an amount of cooking oil? Are we talking a pint, a quart, you know?
It was... maybe 3 cups.
Right. And how big is your pile? Is it at least 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet?
Yes.
Okay. If you can go into your pile and there's a big chunk of congealed stuff, that would be always good to get it out of there. It's not going to be any benefit to you. So if you can look around in there and you can see like a big softball or football size thing, then just take that and toss it into the woods or into your trash or something like that. Otherwise, what I would recommend is if you're only adding your own coffee grounds, get a big load of coffee grounds from a local coffee shop or something like that, a place that serves breakfast. Get a 20-pound bag or something and mix it in and turn your pile, really aerate it. Get out there with a couple of pitchforks, whoever the guilty parties might be, and really fork that material around and mix in the coffee grounds really good, and that'll get the leaves and the other stuff composting. And the hotter you can get that pile, the more it'll remove any negative elements from any remaining oil. But that's
should I get some black plastic and cover it?
No, that's the opposite. Oxygen is good for a pile. Air moves things along. You don't want to make it non-aerobic.
In the old days, people did that a lot.
People did a lot of stupid things. I mean, they poured gasoline on fence lines. They used mothballs. That's why there aren't as many old gardeners around as there should be. No, especially you're in a dry climate. You don't ever want to tarp your pile. Now, people who have ridiculous amounts of rain, then it's a good idea to cover the pile every once in a while during a downpour so it's not always soaking wet. But you need all the rain you can get, and, you know, just turn it a couple of times.
Okay.
All right, Robin?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Phil, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, it's a real pleasure and honor to be on your show. I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much, Phil. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Philly, in South Philly.
Where?
I'm actually on 13th Street, between Tasker and Morris, the street with all the Christmas lights on it.
Oh, yes, absolutely. For our out-of-town listeners who don't know what we're talking about, sometimes entire blocks will get together and they'll hire an electrician and they will string Christmas lights from house to house across the street, covering the entire block. And you're on one of those blocks?
Yeah, I think we got either first prize or second prize last year in the city competition.
Yeah, it's a great place to live, very fraternal. What can we do for Phil in South Philly?
So last winter, my fig tree that was just a great, great producer got what I thought was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of went into mourning, didn't pay any attention to it. And then all of a sudden in around end of May, I saw green sprouts coming up from the roots.
So it rose from the dead.
Yeah, it did. It was kind of miraculous, which was actually good because it had gotten too big, ironically.
But, right.
So it looked like it was going to produce fruits. They came out very late. And then they never matured, but they stayed on the branches right now. And I wasn't sure what I should do, whether I should, I assume I should pull off those figs. And I've noticed it also has like the tips of green leaves growing out of it as if it thinks it's spring. And I was worried that maybe it's just gotten totally confused about what time of year it is or what.
Yes and no. A lot of figs died back to the ground last year. You know, you people in South Philly, you have it pretty easy because you're in the heat sink of the city.
There you go, yeah.
Figs grow like mad and very rarely need winter protection. You go out to the northeast of Philadelphia, you get outside the city, a fig like yours would have to be wrapped up, would have to be protected from the winter winds.
Huh.
So your fig tree was alive the whole time. It died back to the roots. And then what happened is it didn't have enough of a season to grow the figs to maturity. If you had called me a couple of months ago, maybe, and said, what do I do? Because that's when it was just beginning to produce fruits, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would have suggested you go out and get some row cover, a breathable fabric blanket. Biggest brand name is called Reme. And wrap that around the fig to keep it warmer and maybe ripen those figs up. But you say your plant is still green.
Yeah, and that was actually what was worrying me because it almost looks like it's trying to put out spring leaves. So I just didn't know if it was just totally freaking out.
It's probably trying to go through its normal growth cycle of X number of days, which it's not going to have.
Oh, I see.
The basic answer is you don't want to prune it.
Okay.
Your choices are take the figs off, bring them inside, and see if anything good happens. If not, just compost them.
Right.
The cowboy choice, the crazy choice, would be to go out and get one of these fabric row covers or like a breathable blanket, like a sheet.
Okay.
Not plastic or anything like that. And wrap the tree in it. And, you know, if we get a real warm spell, and because it sounds like the tree is still alive and green and actively growing, it's possible that those figs could ripen up.
Huh.
No matter what, it should be fine unless we get another hellacious polar vortex winter.
Now, could I have done that with my tomato plants before we got the... Okay.
No. Tomatoes, I mean, sometimes you can extend their season by a couple of weeks or something. But we didn't have a gradual winter. We went from fall to even in the city well below freezing, literally overnight. So that's the kind of season where you just give up, bring your green tomatoes inside, let them ripen up on the counter. If you're worried about the winter, same thing. Drive some stakes into the ground or gently wrap row cover around it. If you're going to use burlap, I would insist you put stakes in the ground. Wrap the burlap around the stakes, and that would just break the winter wind. That will never hurt your fig tree to give it a little protection from the winter wind. No matter what you do now, after winter comes and goes and things start warming up, and you see new growth on your fig tree, then go out and give it a light pruning. Take off any parts that were damaged or killed over the winter. And even if nothing got harmed over the winter, just give it a gentle haircut all around, and that'll stimulate flowering and fruiting a little earlier.
Huh. Okay.
All right, Phil?
Well, great. Thank you so much.
All right, man. Good luck.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and assure everybody that it is close to impossible to get those stinky holiday paper whites to rebloom. So you can toss those tiny bulbs after they're done flowering with a clear conscience. But don't go asking Al Gore if that idea is okay with him just yet, because we'll be right back with the First Fruits to Fruit and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Holly Tone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929, and wishing all a happy new year.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we are going to discuss which fruits are the first to fruit, which produce produces its produce the most promptly, after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Melissa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show. I'm so excited.
Well, thank you for being had, Melissa. Where are you?
I am in Ardmore, PA.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Melissa just outside of Philadelphia?
I am looking to build a planter box. It may be an elevated one if I can get one that's prefab and just assemble it, because I'm not very handy.
Right.
It's going to be about 2 foot wide by 6 or 8 feet long. And I have no idea what ratios or how to fill it for soil. as far as drainage, and I just want to plant flowers in it and not kill them.
Right. And how high off the ground do you want it to be?
So the ones I found are 29 inches high, but it's so it's about 10 inches deep. So if I had it on the ground, it'd be probably another 10 inches. So between 10 and 20 inches deep.
Oh, okay. And what's it made out of?
Cedar.
Oh, okay.
Do you recommend something different?
No. Cedar wood is excellent. It's rot resistant. Now, one thing I want to mention, though, depending on your situation, we did have a young man on the show over the summer who had invented what he called a garden on wheels, W-H-E-E-L-Z. And this is a raised bed that really is on wheels. It's got this great planter tray that's about a foot deep, and the whole thing is about 3 feet long, 2 feet wide. And it eliminates the problem of what to do with the unnecessary area. If you're growing flowers, for instance, in a box, that's why God made window boxes.
Yeah.
You know, the great thing about a window box is they tend to be just enough soil depth and keep the plants happy, but without you having to spend a fortune or to create something that's going to get heavy down at the bottom over time. So if your situation would allow you to install window boxes, that's the easiest answer, and then everybody gets to go home early. In any kind of planter, the most important things are good drainage. Then, typically, like in this garden on wheels or my outdoor containers or window boxes or anything like that where you're growing in a container, the ideal mix is a combination of what's called soil-free mix. It may be called seed-starting soil. It may be called potting soil. But the ingredients will be some combination of peat or core, perlite, vermiculite, and generally it'll say like composted forest products, which means tree bark that is actually returned to a dirt-like state. And the reason it's called a soil-free mix is the one thing that's missing from it is no bogus topsoil or, quote, soil of any kind. It's nice and light. And should you be comparing products, you want the lightest possible one. You want to buy a bag that's as big as you and weighs about 10 pounds.
Oh, okay. I would never have thought that.
Yes, and that's one of the components. The other component should be finished compost, which is more and more available in bulk or in a bag. Not composted manures, because that would decrease the blooms of your flowers. It would feed the plants. You'd get huge plants, but you wouldn't get as many flowers.
Okay.
You want real compost. And then the other component that I'm using more and more is called perlite, P-E-R-L-I-T-E. This is a great soil lightener, whether you're in raised beds, containers, anything like that. If you've ever bought plants in six packs at a garden center, and you've taken them out, and you see those little white balls in the soil that everybody thinks are styrofoam or something like that. But they're not. They're actually very cool. Perlite is a mined mineral. It's a volcanic glass that's popped in these giant ovens. And when they pop this volcanic glass, it forms little balls. So you could make a planter half perlite. And it would greatly lighten the load on the bottom, fill up the space, and with that amount of perlite, it would drain like magic. Now, if you're going to have a container that you're going to have to fill more than a foot and a half deep, I recommend, for instance, in situations like this, I like tabletop gardening. You get a real sturdy or good-looking table, and then you put rectangular planters on top of it. So again, you're taking care of that distance issue because you really don't need good soil below a foot and a half. So normally, the old advice for all container gardening used to be to put rocks or stones or broken pots or something in the bottom, which is totally bogus. Unless you're growing shallow-rooted plants and you have a deep container. If that's the case, you can feel free to either make it a false bottom where you got a board in there with some good drainage so it looks like it's all full of dirt, but actually the dirt is just on the top foot and a half. If you can't do that, then you can fill the bottom with stones or rocks or something like that. But you don't want to waste 4 foot of good soil if you're just growing pansies or petunias or something like that.
Right, because they only need the foot and a half.
Yeah, exactly.
That's only viable.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And
that makes sense.
They'll be really happy with that. But you're smart to ask, because the biggest mistake people make is filling it with the topsoil or garden dirt, and they never get good results.
This has been super helpful. Thank you so much.
All right. My pleasure, Melissa. Good luck.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care.
1-888-346-9499. Terry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello,
Glad
Terry.
To be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Where are you from, man?
Northern Missouri, north of St. Joseph, Missouri.
What can we do for Terry in Missouri?
I had a nice shrub near my house, and a very vigorous deciduous shrub, and I let it get out of hand. It got away from me. Get to be like, I suppose, 18 feet tall and 8 feet wide.
Started oh, okay.
Rubbing on the house.
Yeah.
And I decided to kill it somehow or another. It was too big to prune mechanically for me, so I didn't use brush killer. I'm an old farmer, but I had a lot of experience with brush killer and hurting my neighbor's roses and things like that. So I used stock salt, and it worked real good. It killed 90% of it. But there's still a few limbs left alive on the south side. Now, if I ruined the bush, should I just go ahead and kill it, or could I keep it for a nice bush?
You say it's deciduous, which means that it drops its
yes.
leaves. It almost sounds like it's a tree, Terry.
Well, it was a shrub. I bought it from Henry Fields for a shrub.
Right. You don't remember what it was or supposed to be.
No, not exactly. Real vigorous, though.
Yeah, seems it. It seems it. And
yeah.
you poured rock salt on it, and most of it died.
Right. I'd say 90% of it died.
And now you're having...
Worked real good.
Right. Now you're... It's bad for your lawn, though.
Actually, it's a pretty high rainfall area. It looks like the bluegrass is coming back.
Oh, okay, good. That's a good thing.
I put about 50 pounds of stock salt on it.
Wow. That is a good thing to remind people of this time of year. If they get rock salt on their lawn from the road cleaning crews or from their own de-icer, the best thing you can do is try to flush it out of the grass as soon as possible and with as much water as possible. So I'm curious as to why you just didn't cut this sucker down.
It's just too big to do mechanically. You know, you take a chainsaw to something like that, it's dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was way too big to do with hand tools.
So now it has no leaves on it, and it's around...
No, not this time of year. Right.
And now it's around 18 feet tall.
There's only a couple branches left alive. I'd say, you know, there's just like two branches left alive. It's fairly small, what's left.
Well, you know, sooner...
Can I leave them? Can they...
Well, I but you don't want it that size, right?
Right. I could cut those two branches down and let them bush out again, if they will. That's what I'm asking you. Will they bush out again and be a nice little shrub?
Your best chance is to get some help or get a big ladder, put it against the side of the shrub while you've got the leaves off, and get up there and prune off the whole top half of the shrub over winter.
Yes, I can do that.
And then, while we're up there, get rid of any branches you don't like, any really completely, most sincerely dead branches. Bring it in on the sides a little bit. And when it hits the ground running in the spring, it sounds like you gave it quite a beating, but it sounds like
yes.
it may still be breathing. So
yes,
this would be, over the winter would be the time to really reduce its height. You kind of gone for broke already, so I would get rid of about half of it, leave the stuff that looks healthy to you, and then see how it greens up in the spring. And then every spring, just when it starts to green up again, I would prune it back by about a third so that it doesn't get too big again.
Okay.
All right.
What I'm really asking, the big basic root system, most of it's probably dead. Will it stay dead forever, or will this reestablish a nice root system?
If you've still got good greenery up top, there may be parts of the root system that are still alive. Now, because you call it a shrub, there could be a lot of things underground. A tree would have one kind of centralized root system that goes down and then has feeder roots going out in all directions. But some shrubs are like lengthwise roots, and some parts of that can be harmed and some parts of it can survive. So, again, I think the most important thing you got to do, because you're going to have to do this anyway, is reduce it in size by half over winter, and then in the spring let the shrub tell you, because the spring will tell the tale. It'll either leaf out, or then you'll know you have to remove the rest of it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right, Terry. Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Jim. I'm over in Sewell, South Jersey.
I'll be right over, Jim. No.
Thank you. I have a question about composting.
Okay.
I have a fairly good-sized pile. It's about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet of all my chopped-up fall leaves that I chopped up with the lawnmower.
Very good.
Now, this year, I've come across a pretty good supplier of coffee grounds. And I can get from maybe 10 to 15 cups of coffee grounds a week from this lady, which I have been stirring into the pile along with some, you know, vegetable peelings from the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the pile, it's cooking pretty good. The other morning when it was 20 degrees, the inside of the pile was 95 degrees.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that would be comfortable for us.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, cooking really good is $1.40.
Okay, well, you know, it's an open pile. It's just surrounded by chicken wire.
That's not the limiting factor, Jim.
Okay.
The limiting factor might be the amount of kitchen scraps you're adding, because they are cold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a compost pile theoretically should consist of dry brown materials, well shredded. That's your fall leaves. And a hot source of nitrogen, what the commonly called wet greens.
Yes.
But I don't like to call them wet greens, because the best wet greens are coffee grounds, and they're brown to black, you know. So.
Okay.
So, you know, and 95 is certainly better than the ambient air temperature. There's nothing wrong with that. You're definitely cooking along.
Okay, my question actually was, because I heard on one of your previous shows when you were talking to a listener about blueberries and coffee grounds, comes with the acidity of the coffee grounds. Am I putting too much acid in?
No. Acid is life in a chemical reaction. If you want to prevent most chemical reactions or to put one out, you go alkaline. But to make things coalesce, you drop them into an acid, right?
Okay.
And that recreates them into another form, remember.
Okay, so when the compost is all finally fully composted, then the acidity will not be a problem.
Correct.
Beautiful.
Compost piles tend to move towards neutral as they are finished.
Okay.
And the easiest way to tell when they are finished is the old rule, when you can no longer recognize your original ingredients.
Yes.
And it passes the duck test.
The duck test. Okay.
In other words, does it look like rich black compost? Does it smell like rich black compost?
Okay.
And does it feel like rich black compost?
Okay.
If it does, then it's a duck and it's ready to put on top of your garden.
Okay. Then in past years, I've been doing pretty good. And from what you say, this year I'm doing fine, except for the kitchen scraps.
Well, it's so controversial. I mean, I hesitate to bring this up because people get mad at me.
Yeah.
Because most people begin composting because they want to recycle their kitchen waste. And that is 112% a good thing. The problem is, outside of coffee grounds and eggshells, there's very precious little in that waste that's going to contribute to your garden.
Okay.
And if you go really nuts, you know, if you're a healthy eater, and you're really piling in the broccoli cores and the spoiled string beans and the outside leaves of lettuce,
Yeah.
You can actually slow the pile down without adding much to it that's going to help your garden, which is why I'm always trying to get people who have a lot of kitchen scraps to either make much larger compost piles. You know, for instance, your puny 3 cubic feet pile. Jim, how dare you? How dare you call that large?
It's 3 by 3 by 3.
Yeah, that's 3 cubic feet. I got compost piles the size of a mini car. Come on. Get in the game, Jim.
All right, I'll make it bigger.
I'll
forget about the kitchen scraps.
Well, you don't want to throw them away either. Take a look at a worm bin. Worm bins are great, and unlike in a compost pile, you can feed technically worthless kitchen scraps to red worms in a bin, and they will turn it into a material that looks like compost but is actually more nutritious and plant-friendly.
Okay, so basically stick with the leaves and the coffee grounds for now, and I should be in good shape.
And get yourself a worm bin.
A worm bin. Okay, Mike, thanks a lot.
All right, Jim.
Have a good day.
You too, sir.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody with a cut Christmas tree still in the house to make sure that there's always fresh water in the tree stand. If it goes dry, green and spiky your carpet will be. But don't go dousing with your holiday dipstick just yet, because we'll be right back with the first fruits to fruit and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Holly Tone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929, and wishing all a happy new year. You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Grand American Tours. In July of 2015, Mike McGrath will be hosting a Viking river cruise through the gardens of Provence. More at 800-423-0247 or grandamericantours.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch right now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to our intriguing question of the week. What is the first fruit that a fruit grower can produce early in the season? Isn't it intriguing? What is the first sweet fruit you can eat from your own garden? We think we got the answer, and we'll deliver it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Tom.
I'm calling from Roanoke, Virginia.
Oh, I love the Roanoke area.
I've got a question about safety related to indoor fluorescent lights.
Oh, sure.
I have a new fairly new baby. He's about 1 year old, crawling around and walking, pulling things.
Right,
I think about setting up one of those metal racks where you have like the lights, you know, and you can adjust the height of the light to grow, like you said, two bulbs or four bulbs. And I was just wondering, you know, with the kids looking up at the lights, is there any danger, I don't know, of UV rays or harmful to the eyes at all or neurologic development related to these fluorescent lights?
I think that's a great question. I think you'll probably find really good answers because fluorescent lighting is used so much in industrial settings and in office settings. One thing I remember way back when I was a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News, is when the computers came in the newsroom, they had a lighting engineer come in and essentially turn the lights upside down. Instead of shining down, they were bouncing off the ceiling because that was supposed to be safer for your eyes while your eyes were looking into those early computer screens, which I think themselves were more dangerous than anything we're talking about. But my first concern, of course, would be this child who is about to experience full mobility with zero knowledge of danger, you know, pulling the whole schmageggy down. That would be my big danger, is you want to have this in a place where the kid can't make it fall down, go boom. Because when fluorescent lights break, it's no fun. And, you know, having all your plants all over the floor at week five of 6 weeks indoors is no fun either. My wife and I have fluorescent lights, plant lights in our dining room. What I learned to do was to angle them towards the plants. We have a four-tube fixture, 4 foot long, four tubes in it, that's shining on all our indoor houseplants, which includes regular houseplants like snake plant and all the begonias I bring inside for the winter and things like alpine strawberries and stuff. So I have angled this thing so that it's not hanging straight down over the plants, but it's angled back at them. And that was mostly just because we found the light annoying. We like having the brightness over winter, but we didn't want the light in our eyes. So angling just the tiniest bit, I found, reduces that whole issue. I mean, makes it moot because now the light's not shining at you. And one thing that has always been an issue with artificial lighting of plants is you want to keep fluorescence close to the top of the plants, but a lot of times as the plants get big, say you have tomato plants growing inside the house and they're at week five, and they still got another week to go, they're not getting nearly enough light down low. So angling the lights towards them and away from human eyes removes any kind of issue whatsoever and gives you better, more well-rounded plant growth. The other answer is that a true shop light fixture will have that shield over top that really keeps the light away. And there is no harm and every good reason to hang some aluminum foil down from the edge of that shield going down and reflecting more light onto the sides of the plants. So you allay your concerns, and you're only helping the plants. You can't be hurting them by giving them more light down low.
Well, that's great. I like the aluminum fold. I wouldn't have even thought of that. But it's
yeah,
so awesome.
I don't know where divine inspiration, you know. All right, man,
so
good
much,
luck,
Parker.
and congratulations on your child. Enjoy this time. It's a tremendous time.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, good luck, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Marsha, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm a longtime listener and organic gardener.
Excellent.
I love your show. I have a question about my peonies.
Okay. I have a question for you.
Okay.
Where is Marsha?
I'm outside of Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, in Chester County.
I know where Phoenixville is. I did my TED talk at the Historic Colonial Theater in Phoenixville a few years back, and what a great experience that was. I got 250,000 views on YouTube so far.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I go to the Colonial all the time. It is a great theater.
It's a local treasure. So yep. What can we do for Marcia in Phoenixville?
Well, I have this peony garden. It's at least 20 years old. There's about 14 or 15 plants. And I notice I'm getting fewer blooms. And we have three big 5-gallon buckets of leftover wood ash from our fireplace. And I was wondering if I can put that on the peonies.
One of the primary rules of gardening, I learned this back at Organic Gardening Magazine, and it gets reinforced like monthly on this show,
mm-hmm.
is just because you have a lot of something does not mean that it belongs on your garden. Matter of fact, most of the time, that equal sign will have a line right through it. You know, don't
uh-huh.
do this. Don't dump 15 gallons of wood ash on your peonies. Don't try to light a cigarette inside an airplane restroom. You know, same universal symbol there. So now your peonies are, let's just deal with them for a second. You say the blooms are starting to get not as good as they were.
Well, you know, they were never great. A lot of them were transplanted from my grandmother's house, and I've heard peonies don't like to be transplanted.
Yeah, but that's a long time ago, right?
Right. Some are 20 years old. Some are, 10, 5.
Yeah, even a drama queen is going to give up after 5 or 10.
Yeah.
So now,
I neglect them. I don't
that's
do
fine.
A whole lot.
That's fine. I have never fed or cared for my peonies. And we have the same kind, I'm presuming. We have herbaceous peonies that die back to the ground over winter and come back up in the spring.
Yes.
Okay. Now, are they getting good sun?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So they get good sun. They're not blazing in full sun, are they?
Yep. They're right out in the middle of the yard. They don't really have any trees around them.
Okay, yeah, but, they're pretty much done blooming by the time summer gets really intense.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't see the leaves showing any signs of sunstroke or anything like that.
No, no.
Okay.
And, I mean, I get blooms from them.
Right.
I get plenty of blooms. But
okay, good.
I really haven't fed them other than the initial composting when I dug my garden at least 20 years ago.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do. If you live near a really hip garden center, or if you don't mind ordering it online,
mm-hmm.
I want you to get a bag of rock phosphate.
Okay.
Rock phosphate is a natural mined mineral, completely approved for organic agriculture. It's mined out of big phosphorus deposits, and it's the best source of elemental phosphorus, which is the blooming nutrient. If you see these chemical fertilizers that claim to be bloom boosters, they're chemical phosphorus, and it's much superior to use rock phosphate. You don't need a lot. It'll come in a fairly small bag, and you shouldn't use more than a quarter to a half a cup per plant. And you'd want to spread that around. Ideally now, if you can. If you can't, you can do it in the spring. But whenever you spread the rock phosphate, you want to cover it with more compost. That's how you're going to feed your plants.
Well, what am I going to do with my leftover wood ash?
Oh, your wood ash is highly alkaline. The only good use for wood ash is when someone has a lawn whose soil tests acidic. And they want to spread agricultural lime on it. Wood ash can be used instead of agricultural lime at about the same rate. But if you spread it near acid-loving plants or on plants that like a neutral soil or plants that are already in a neutral soil, it'll kill everything.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Mike.
All right. Good luck, Marcia.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Which fruit fruits the earliest? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read this week's anticipatory question.
Sure, Mike. Jim in Zone 5 near Chicago writes, I'm planning a garden and would like to get fresh fruit for as much of the year as possible. What's the earliest fruiting plant I could grow here? I have full sun and would be willing to start things indoors or put up a hoop house if it wasn't too huge. 5 feet would be about as high as I could do.
Well, a 5-foot hoop house would be darn difficult to work in unless you happen to be 4 foot tall, Jim. Hoop houses are outdoor structures that are typically around 8 feet high at their peak, just like the ceiling of a regular house. My friend George DeVault grows almost all of his Pheasant Hill Farm produce in hoop houses, and too tall George wouldn't be able to walk into one that was even 6 feet high. But they really do speed up the harvest. The raspberries he's grown in hoop houses have come in weeks ahead of my outdoor ones.
So you're saying that Jim should grow raspberries in hoop houses?
Not unless he has a lot of room for the right kind of structure. And if he's a beginning gardener, he should start slow and work on a smaller scale. There are many kinds of mini hoop houses, about a foot or so tall, that are great at extending the season for low-growing plants like June-bearing strawberries, which also might be the earliest fruit somebody in a cold climate could grow.
Is that what our fruit-growing expert Lee Reich told you?
Yes, but it was also one of my guesses when I sent him the email. Anyway, June-bearing strawberries really do bear fruit in June, especially if they're grown under hooped row covers, or if you're careful to vent them on sunny days, clear plastic tunnels. But they don't bear that fruit until their second year in the ground. What Lee likes to term so-called ever-bearing strawberries produce fruits their first year in the ground.
Why so-called ever-bearing?
Well, as Lee explains in his excellent book, Grow Fruit Naturally, they more realistically bear two crops, one in the spring and a second longer run in late summer through fall. Now, there's also a third type of strawberry called day neutral that bears all summer long, unless there's scorching heat, which is not a typical Chicago area problem.
So, strawberries early and often?
Well, you know, there's worse ideas. And if he really wants to try and grow a decent amount of food, he should try all three types. Who doesn't like strawberries? And they're low-growing, which makes them ideal for row covers, tunnels, and other season-extending devices that produce their produce a few weeks earlier in the season.
Are strawberries the absolute earliest fruit he could get?
I quote Lee directly. Strawberries would be the earliest unless he really wanted to go out on a figurative limb, ha-ha, with honeyberries, which Lee says he is personally, quote, still testing, but so is everybody else. These fruits are really new to the scene. But Lee says there's a lot of interest in them, especially in Canada, where new varieties are being continually developed.
What are honeyberries?
Well, the fruits look like blueberries, grow on shrubs, taste great fresh, and ripen before June-bearing strawberries. The plants themselves are related to honeysuckle and are ridiculously cold-hardy. The temperature can drop below zero after they flower, and you'll still get fruit.
But it sounds like they're still kind of experimental.
Absolutely. Growers are still trying to figure out exactly how these plants work. Lee says to, quote, think apples 1,500 years ago. But they have great potential for producing really tasty fruits very early in the season. Now, if you want a safer, more established bet, June berries bear their tasty fruits just a few weeks later, and they've been cultivated successfully for centuries.
June berries? That's different than June-bearing strawberries?
Yes, June berries, which may be much better known as service berries, are an ancient plant used by Native Americans, tribes up in Canada, and the earliest settlers of the far north. Some species are shrubs and some are small trees. Lee explains that the fruits look a little bit like blueberries, but taste more like sweet cherries with a hint of almond and are delicious eaten fresh, which most growers should be able to do before the end of June.
Are there any negatives?
Lee says you'll have to fight the birds for every single one, just like with blueberries. So make sure they're protected with netting or fencing and or some sort of bird scare device. And don't delay picking when they're ripe.
Now, what if Jim means fruiting plants in the larger sense, like tomatoes, peppers, and such?
In brief, start the plants indoors under bright lights 2 months before you're going to plant them out. use season-extending devices to put them out safely a little early in the season, and choose varieties labeled early or cold hardy, the ones with the shortest numbers of days to maturity. Once you get good at this game, you should be able to pick tasty little tomatoes by the 4th of July. Well, that sure was some intriguing advice about early homegrown fruit, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes! My producer is threatening to steal my service berries if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, as long as you include your location, at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work. And please say you like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor, Al Banks, well, he's almost never early. Late to bed and early to rise is intrepid Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. On an average, it seems, of 3 hours sleep a day. Our production assistant, Peter Christian, arrives early, stays late, and sells popcorn in the stand in between innings. Our hired hand, Matt Hudecki, he eats popcorn in the stand in between innings. I'm suddenly craving popcorn, Mike McGrath, so I'm off just to get a little, you know, organic, air-popped, lightly salted. Ooh, maybe with just a little bit of butter on it. No, I'm not allowed to have butter. Just a little, and then I'll be off saturated fats for good. Yeah, oh, they're so tasty. Honest, Doc, really. No, look at my HDL. That's the one that counts. Stop looking at the LDL. No, look, really, it's organic butter. From pasture-raised cows who milk themselves, were paid a living wage, and they get to retire in India after 4 years. What? Yes, I know it's still butter. Why do you think I want it? Hey, look over there. Oh, that's better. All right, now I can hold out until I see you again. Next week. Oh, God, it's so good. Oh, it's so good. Have you always wanted to have the first ripe tomatoes on the block? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the secrets behind super early tomato success, plus your fabulous phone calls.